On this episode of China Unscripted, the system is broken in Hong Kong, what protesters have learned from Bruce Lee, and liberty without democracy. Welcome to China Unscripted. I'm Chris Chappell.
I'm Shelley Zhang.
And I'm Matt Ganesda.
And joining us today is Anthony Dapperin, a Hong Kong-based writer, lawyer, and photographer. He's also the author of the book City of Protest, A Recent History of Dissent in Hong Kong. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks. It's a pleasure to be with you.
You've essentially written the book on Hong Kong's protest culture, literally. So what do you think of the recent protests against the extradition bill? Are they similar to what you've seen in the past?
They're really similar, but also different in really interesting ways. They are similar, I guess, to the protests that we saw in 2003 here over another proposed law that was controversial. That was the so-called Article 23 law, which was proposing to introduce sort of national security, anti-sedition, anti-subversion laws into Hong Kong. Like this time around, there was a pretty strongly unified consensus in the community opposing that draft law, and again, large numbers of people came out into the streets, not as large as this time, but it was sort of a historic high at the time, and the government in that case withdrew the draft law and it never appeared again. So this time around, it's been a similar dynamic. The government proposed a law that was really unpopular, obviously provoked huge feeling among the community here in Hong Kong, and people came out not just in their hundreds of thousands, but in their millions to protest it. This time around, the government haven't used the word withdraw, but I think we can sort of generally agree that it's all been but withdrawn in practice. So that's sort of the parallel, I think, between this time around and last time around.
Well, actually, I want to ask this with the withdrawal part. We still have seen the Chinese Communist Party saying they support the extradition bill, which I'm sure makes a lot of people nervous that this isn't really done.
Yeah. I mean, the government has, I have a feeling it's sort of an issue of face at this point. Mm-hmm. You know, the government have said, you know, it's on hold with no timetable for it to be reintroduced. They've also pointed out that the legislative timetable only has a year or so to go until we have elections next year, which would then, you know, at that point, the current parliament is dissolved and all the laws that haven't been gone through this time around are automatically withdrawn. So they're sort of saying, look, in practice, it's gone and it's not going to come back, but we're not going to use the word withdraw because that would make us look like we're giving in to the protesters. But I think the practical effect is probably the same thing. And I think we're not going to see it come back in the next year anyway. Mm-hmm. So that's the comparison with 2003. The other kind of obvious comparison, and I think in this case there's a lot of points of difference, is with the umbrella movement of 2014. That was another large-scale protest that Hong Kong saw, again, made TV screens around the world. That one was unsuccessful, finished up at the end of 2014 after a 79-day occupation with the protesters getting none of their demands met. And that protest was also different in that it had a very clear sort of centralized organized leadership. And one thing that people have commented on that distinguished the current protests from 2014 is that this movement seems to be much more leaderless, or if not leaderless, at least the leadership are sort of, well, the people coordinating the protests are very much off the radar, and the things are happening in online chat groups and private message groups and those sorts of things. And a lot more spontaneous sort of activity from the crowd, and a lot more mobile. They move to a different place, you know, every day, sort of doing hit and run style protests rather than settling down in the one spot for a lengthy occupation. So, in that way, this lot of protests has been different to the most recent big protests we saw in the umbrella movement.
Mm-hmm. So, what you're saying is there's room for a charismatic foreign person who maybe has like a popular TV show about China to come into the scene and assume a leadership position.
Yeah, but if a charismatic foreign person did that, they'd be really playing into the hands of the sort of foreign forces narrative. That it's interesting because, you know, the Chinese government, and sort of the pro-Beijing politicians have been saying, you know, all these protests is just foreign forces,
CIA causing, paid and bad.
Yeah, exactly, causing trouble. And if anyone who's spent any time down at those protest marches knows that, you know, there's, you know, it's not, you know, not sensible or possible, even kind of within the bounds of sort of, you know, any kind of rational explanation that that's what's going on.
We were at the protests yesterday where they were going from consulate to consulate ahead of the G20.
Yeah.
And there was one woman who was actively shouting, "We need foreign interventions."
Right. Yeah. Yes. They're asking. Also, the t-shirts that they have said, like, liberate Hong Kong on them?
Yeah, that's an interesting turn that they seem to take yesterday, right? Yeah. And you've seen, I saw also some graffiti that said something like, Trump, please come and free Hong Kong or something like that, which is an unusual request.
there was a big, like, they had graffitied it onto the road in the middle of the night. So that was interesting to see.
I think the protesters are keenly aware that, I think especially with the G20 meetings coming up this week, that international attention is in some way helpful to their cause, in the sense that, Hong Kong's an international city, a lot of businesses and people around the world have interests here or care about what happens in the place, and getting that international media attention, international governments talking about it is going to be helpful. But at the same time, China has always had this aversion to foreign interference and going back to, the century of national humiliation, all those kind of things that, it can very easily become counterproductive to the protesters' sort of aims. So it's a kind of interesting balance that they need to sort of find when they're sort of engaging with foreign parties, I guess.
I am kind of surprised that as far as I know, the Chinese government hasn't commented yet on the kind of language that they used about like liberating Hong Kong or, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, anything that smacks of self-determination or independence is the so-called red line that Xi Jinping laid down. I think if any of that sort of rhetoric gets an airing in the media, then or is raised in official channels with China, I think it'll get a pretty stern response. It'd be interesting to see, because this is something that, as you say, sort of was mentioned the last couple of days. It wasn't there in the big protests going back a couple of weeks. So it'll be interesting to see as we come up to the 1st of July protests, whether that kind of line of demands from the protesters is kind of continued to be pursued and how that's articulated.
Well, I know the Chinese Communist Party has essentially demanded that none of the other G20 countries even bring up Hong Kong during the meetings. How much of this do you think is just them not wanting to even talk about it right now?
Yeah, I think they feel, as with any other things related to China, that it's an internal affair and they don't want it to even talk about it with any other foreign countries. And I think I have no doubt they'll be successful in keeping it off the official agenda. I think what the protesters are aiming for with the newspaper advertisements and the rallies and so on and the visits to the consulates is to at least get it being talked about in the corridors. And it talked about on the in the side discussions and perhaps not on the official agenda, but when the other countries' delegates are meeting with the Chinese delegates to sort of ask, hey, by the way, what's going on in Hong Kong? So to at least get it as one of the issues that are kind of in the air around on the sidelines of the meetings. That's probably the best they can hope for, I would think.
And the answer is, of course, that nothing's happening in Hong Kong. 800,000 Hong Kongers definitely support the extradition bill. Yeah, yeah.
No, according to official state-run media.
China Daily.
That's right. Yeah.
Well, so you mentioned Article 23, and so there's a comparison there. Article 23 was this pretty scary national security bill, and I think it was about 500,000 people came out to protest that. Why did the extradition bill get 2 million people out, or as Carrie Lam has said, at least a few thousand people?
Yeah, it's interesting. Why did this get even more people out than the Article 23 protests? I think it probably goes to sort of a general feeling of unhappiness that's sort of been festering in the community for the last few years. In 2003, the discontent obviously was around the law itself, the Article 23 law, and then the broader discontent was sort of around the economic situation in Hong Kong at the time. We just had SARS. Tung Chee Hwa was sort of bumbling along with various initiatives that weren't quite working. So it was sort of broadly speaking an economic discontent, which I think helped swell those numbers. This time around, none of those sort of underlying, social justice, inequality, property price issues have gone away. And on top of that, we've had the last 5 years where, following the umbrella movement, the government has been really tightening the screws on dissent. We've had the legislative disqualifications. We've had various candidates being barred from running for office, the prosecutions of all the umbrella movement leaders. And all of that didn't get a strong response from the public. And I think that sort of, rather than, it wasn't the fact that people didn't care about any of that stuff, it's just sort of been buried and slowly building in terms of another source of anxiety for people. So that when this issue came up, the extradition law issue came up, there were all these other grievances, all this sense of, you know, their, you know, the people's democratically expressed will through the ballot box in the LegCo led to their candidates being disqualified and kicked out. And plus on top of that, you know, the economic and broader sort of social justice issues. And I think that just sort of snowballed into something that is, you know, a big ball of sort of discontent that had to be expressed in this way. That might help explain why the numbers were even bigger than anyone expected, I think.
Well, I think you touch on an interesting point. From the people that we've been interviewing in Hong Kong, like Emily Lau, there's a sense that the system of Hong Kong is broken.
Yeah.
That the people have, because of the legislator's disqualification, they have no way to actually influence or have a say in the government, and so in a way protests have become institutionalized. That's the only option they have.
I would agree with that entirely. And it's, if I may, you know, be slightly self-serving, it's one of the key arguments in my book, that you know, Hong Kong is this place, as Chris Patten described it, that has liberty without democracy. So, you know, there isn't a democratic system that enables people to you know, properly express their views through those channels, and the government is not accountable to the people through that mechanism, but they have the liberties that enables them to take to the streets and protest. They have freedom of expression, freedom of assembly, all those rights and freedoms. So, you know, as you say, and as Emily, you know, I entirely agree with Emily Lau on this point, you know, protest becomes, you know, the only effective channel for political expression and has become institutionalized over the years in Hong Kong, not least because it's been successful on several occasions. You know, Article 23 is a notable one. The National Moral Education Curriculum in 2012, which was sort of the first big protest that Joshua Wong led, was also a success. And I think the other element potentially driving the big protest numbers is the sense that Hong Kongers understand that the Hong Kong government are not accountable to them. They're ultimately accountable to Beijing. And I think there's also a suspicion that when Hong Kong officials go up to Beijing to report back on what's happening here, they're not necessarily giving a frank and honest account of the genuine feelings of the Hong Kong people. So there's perhaps this sense that, you know, if Beijing kind of having the wool pulled over their eyes by the Hong Kong government reps when they go up and visit them, you know, they can't hide from, you know, seeing 2 million of us on the street, and this will let them see how we really feel. So it's sort of, in a way, getting the attention of Beijing and asking Beijing, you know, please, you know, get, you know, push the Hong Kong government to do something.
So you're saying it's a bad idea to hide things from your boss?
Right. Yeah. Yeah, especially if you've got 2 million people who are going to come out and call you on it. Yeah.
Just to back up for a minute, like, I think one of the things in this protest that really changed the dynamic of what was happening was what happened on June 12th, when the protesters went to LegCo in that area, and then the police fired tear gas. You were there, you said?
Yes, I was there that day, yeah.
Can you tell us a little bit about what that was like?
It was, the first and most striking thing was, you know, I got there sort of mid-morning, about 9:30 or so. You know, I knew that there was going to be a protest outside the Legislative Council. I knew that they were going to plan to try and, you know, block the building and stop the meeting going ahead. You know, I kind of, you know, came around the corner, and just to see this massive crowd already there, already completely filling Harcourt Road where the Umbrella Movement occupation had taken place. And it was like the Umbrella Movement had just sort of been instantly resurrected in a matter of hours. Not only were the crowds there, all the supply stations were springing up, you know, people were bringing in all the sort of the protective gear and sort of food and water and first aid gear, and it was all just sort of happening, you know, almost instantaneously without any clear sort of centrally directed organization. And that was just sort of something quite, you know, quite stunning. And knowing that, you know, the Hong Kong government would never have wanted another sort of Occupy situation to arise again, and yet here it was, you know, sort of instantly, you know, before our eyes. So that was sort of the first striking thing. And then, you know, in the course of the day, obviously, that the protesters had a win when it was announced that the meetings had been cancelled. And, you know, I wasn't close enough to sort of see exactly what sort of sparked the confrontations with police, but obviously at a certain point, the police decided they wanted to clear the roads, and then began using the, you know, tear gas and rubber bullets and various other sort of measures. And they were, it was very, they were using it very liberally, even from, you know, not right close up to the front lines, but, you know, a block or two away, there was still tear gas drifting around everywhere. and you know, the police were sort of firing it, you know, into the backs of retreating crowds who were already moving away. They were firing it in the middle of, you know, office towers on an ordinary working afternoon midweek, you know, up in by the Pacific Place, one of the big malls, and on the front steps of the High Court. And it was really quite, you know, a kind of pretty out of control situation. And the thing that sort of surprised me most was that in 2014, when the police used tear gas, and I think it had been the first time that tear gas had been used since the protests of the riots of the late 1960s, they used, you know, half as much as they used last Wednesday. And that provoked a really strong reaction from the Hong Kong community at the time. In 2014, people were kind of angry at the police using tear gas at all, and that brought out even more support onto the street. And that, in a way, is, you know, arguably the thing that started the Umbrella Movement occupation. But this time around, it almost seemed like this kind of behavior by the police had been normalized, and everyone was just sort of, you know, that was what they expected. And it wasn't as shocking as it had been 5 years ago. And that, in a way, is sort of a sad comment on the state of affairs in Hong Kong, that, you know, people are no longer shocked to see the police, you know, firing tear gas and, you know, firing rubber bullets into the crowd, and it didn't get, you know, the immediate sort of reaction from the public in terms of everyone coming out to support in the way that they did in 2014. And I guess to go back to your earlier question, that might have been one of the other things that brought so many people out on the Sunday, that they were reacting to what they'd seen on the Wednesday, you know, delayed by a few days, and that also would have, I think, perhaps helped to prompt some people to come out and protest.
Did you experience the tear gas and all that stuff?
Yeah, I did. Yeah, unfortunately, it was. I got caught in a drifting cloud, and it's not very pleasant. You sort of, it stings your eyes, and it's difficult to breathe, and it sort of stings your skin as well. I was sort of with a crowd. We happened to sort of be near the City Hall Design Museum, and a rear door was open, and sort of people were sort of flooding into that rear door where the bathrooms happened to be to sort of wash their faces and wash their eyes and so on. It's quite funny. There was a sort of a cleaning lady, you know, sort of who'd just been obviously working or whatever, and just sort of sitting there leaning on her mop, sort of with a bemused look, watching this crowd of sort of coughing, spluttering, crying people streaming in the back door. And she was just sort of sitting there watching and said, okay, well, you know, another day at the office sort of thing. So, it was a pretty funny situation. Not so funny, you know, having been tear gas, but yeah.
Did you start to rethink some of your life choices at that moment?
No. I mean, I was there, I should clarify, I was there not as a protester, but in my sort of capacity as a writer and commentator and analyst of all of this. So I sort of, you know, like to think that I was collateral damage rather than, you know, the actual target of, but I mean, as I say, it was being so, so liberally deployed that anyone in the vicinity couldn't have avoided it.
Was that surprising that the police would do it to that extent? Because, like you said, it seems normalized now, but it's still, I mean, the last time you used it, it still provoked a reaction.
Yeah. And I think it continues to resonate now. I mean, I think it is one of the things that's really driving the protesters still. And I sort of wonder if the police hadn't reacted that strongly on the Wednesday, and with the government sort of, you know, putting the bill on hold, whether that might have diffused many of the ongoing protests. And I think part of that, you know, the refusal, to, you know, the anger at the police behaviour, the refusal of the government to, you know, have any kind of independent inquiry or investigation of what happened is continuing to fuel, I think, some discontent that's bringing people out into these sort of ongoing protests that we're seeing, you know, in the weeks following that.
Well, we've certainly seen since we've been here, a deterioration in the relationship with the police.
Mm.
When the protesters first occupied the area around the police HQ, they, like, taped up the security camera so they couldn't see. And then when they did it again last night, they started actually spray painting.
Right. Yeah.
So I guess the original idea was that they didn't want to damage the equipment.
Right.
And now it's kind of gotten a little more, because the police have not apologized in any way.
No, there's been
no recognition.
To the contrary, they've, I think, been arguing that they were completely justified in what they did. I mean, that is interesting that there is that element of, you know, there's been some, you know, graffiti and those sorts of things around, which we never saw in the Umbrella Movement. There was sort of no permanent property damage in the Umbrella Movement, whereas, you know, graffiti is something that is sort of a first. There's still been no property, you know, sort of serious property damage in these protests. There's never, you know, it's not sort of a you know, smash things up kind of protest style in Hong Kong. You know, I guess if you had a protests of this scale, you know, elsewhere in the world, you'd have, you know, broken windows and, you know, burning cars and those kind of things.
I mean, but some high-end malls were sheltering students.
Exactly.
So it's hard to claim that they were like rioters.
Exactly. So it's a very different dynamic to what you might expect with large-scale protests elsewhere in the world.
I noticed there was one graffiti. It was like, F the Popo.
Right.
And I'm just thinking, like, I don't imagine Popo is a native Hong Konger slang. So I imagine there's some rowdy expats involved.
There could be.
And that's the foreign interference right there.
That's the foreign interference right there. Oh, geez.
Are there things that have surprised you about these protests?
Yeah, I mean, I've been surprised by the way that the young protesters have just developed and evolved their protesting tactics since the Umbrella Movement. You know, the they saw that long-term occupation didn't work, and the protests that we saw around, you know, closing down various government buildings with pretty small, agile groups of protesters, just a couple of hundred, you know, blocking the entrances until the government sort of says, okay, we're going to, you know, close down the building for the day, everyone go home. And then as soon as they realize, okay, we've achieved our aim, they don't sort of stick around. Like, okay, let's get up and move on to the next target. And they did that, you know, last Friday across a number of different government buildings. They've done it again this morning outside the Department of Justice. It's really smart strategy. You can use small numbers of people to create pretty large disruption. And bear in mind that, you know, most of these protesters are young. I think a lot of them are university students. We're into the summer vacation now for them, and they can keep this up all summer long, right? It's kind of like, how did you spend your summer holiday?
We're just
like,
summer break.
Closing down government buildings all summer long. So
Well, I know this is an interesting point Shelley made, but the idea that the protesters have kind of learned something from Bruce Lee.
Oh, right. Oh. That there are those on Telegram, those kinds of posters going around saying, like, you know, hashtag be water.
Be water. Exactly. No, and there is a sort. I mean, there is a sort of sense that, you know, you don't meet force with force, right? And this sense that, you know, rather than sort of, you know, go into direct conflict with the police, go, you know, be like water, flow to where there's least resistance and be more effective there. So, I've seen those sort of memes going around as well. And it looks like they're making great use of that philosophy. You know, so that's been a really surprising and notable aspect to the way the protests have unfolded. And of course, their use of technology has developed as well, I think, in terms of the Telegram chat groups and the various online groups, the polls that they run to decide what they're going to do next. Should we stay or should we go? And let's run an online poll and decide. The crowdfunding with these newspaper advertisements they've just done. Some really just interesting uses of technology and kind of interesting uses of technology as a model of sort of participatory democracy as well, with these kind of open votes and referendums and these sorts of things.
So, are they doing these votes in the Telegram groups?
I've seen them in Telegram groups. Yeah, I think they do it on the LAHKG forums as well.
Been called the Reddit of Hong Kong. Is that accurate?
Yeah, I think that sounds right. I mean, it's a pretty lo-fi discussion board site. Mm-hmm. I think it's literally just lihkg.com, perhaps. Just post on all different topics. And
And they should give WeChat a try. I hear that's a great platform.
There was this recent Wall Street Journal article that was kind of about, there could be backlash building to the protests. Is that from kind of ordinary Hong Kongers who just resent, you know, the fact that they couldn't put their taxes in because the revenue building was blocked or whatever? Is that a concern?
Yeah, and certainly that draws on, I think, the experience of the Umbrella Movement, right, where the longer that occupation went on, the less, you know, the more the community support dwindled, you know, and I think people got sick of the inconvenience. I think, you know, that in this time around, the protesters did have the benefit of, you know, very unified and broad community support behind the initial cause, you know, to get the extradition bill withdrawn. I think that if the community generally feels that that's been as good as achieved, and if the protesters sort of are moving on to other broader, you know, broader aims, and certainly from the protest last night, we started to see this sort of requests for democracy coming back into some of the rhetoric and some of the slogans and what they're asking for. That might also be a way to dissipate, you know, the broad public community support they've had up until now. That together with, you know, if their actions cause, you know, great inconvenience to the public, you know, that might further help undermine them. It was interesting, I think it was yesterday, after them having closed down the Revenue Tower 2 days ago, yesterday apparently they came back and sort of stood outside holding up signs apologizing for the inconvenience, which is very considerate.
Very interesting.
That's also very British.
Right, yeah, very British, very Hong Kong. Yeah. That's yeah, right.
I did see a video of them like going there and holding up signs, apologizing, and then yeah. there was a one guy who like kind of like walked past and like patted one of the right. like the protesters on the shoulder.
Yeah.
It's okay. Thank you for defending our
freedom. Thank you for your service. Yeah.
I couldn't tell if that Wall Street Journal article was bringing up like a legitimate point or if it was kind of just, you know, you can't keep writing articles about how the protests are, you know, being supported, and then you gotta maybe like get another angle. Is there backlash? And then is there backlash to the backlash?
Yeah, right.
You know?
Yeah. No, for sure. There's that. Yeah, I guess there's only so many things you can say about this, right? Yeah.
Well, I hope not, because you're writing books about
that's
it.
That's right. Yeah.
So, what's the next great angle on the protest? So we can scoop that.
Sure. I mean, I think everyone's looking ahead to 1st of July. I've heard a lot of talk among sort of, you know, friends who are active in the protests that there's a sense that they think that the Hong Kong government and or Beijing are waiting to see what happens on 1st of July before they decide any next steps. There's a sense that, you know, if there's another big turnout on 1st of July, they may be more responsive. If the 1st of July sort of turns out to be a bit of a fizzer, they might then feel that they've kind of won the battle and move on. So I'm seeing a lot of talk about people sort of saying we all have to make sure we get out on 1st of July and show them that we still care and we're still unhappy and we still want the government to act. So I think that's going to be interesting. And then just alluding to what we were just talking about, what message are they communicating on 1st of July? What are they asking for? It seems they have dropped the demand for Carrie Lam to resign. I think partly they feel that that's not likely because that'd be too much of a loss of face for Beijing. And I think they also feel that even if she goes, someone else, you know, is going to replace her who's not going to be any better. So they seem to have sort of given up on that. They had sort of scaled the demands just, you know, back to just focus on the extradition bill and the police violence and the things around that and the charges of the protesters. But then, you know, suddenly over the last couple of days, this the sort of democracy thing has come back again, and we'll see if that becomes a central theme of the protests on Monday and how that develops. So I'm sure we'll see a few more sort of, you know, small-scale protests like we saw this morning around, you know, the edges of the next few days with the G20 meetings, and then Monday will be sort of a pretty big litmus test, I think, for where the movement goes from here and how the government reacts.
Well, we'll definitely be there. Yeah. Are you surprised about how much the Hong Kong government has backed down? Or do you think they even have backed down?
Yeah, I'm on the contrary. I'm sort of surprised how little they've given, because in a way, especially the demands from the protesters last week weren't really big asks. If the government's already said, you know, we're putting the bill on hold, you know, there's no timetable for it to be resumed. You all know there are elections next year. You all know that we're not going to do this before the elections, and then it's going to be withdrawn. Then why don't they just say, okay, it's withdrawn? It's sort of, you know, one tiny step more. It's very symbolic, and they're sort of, in a way, both sides are sort of arguing about semantics at this point on that. But the other things, like, you know, just having a public statement where they come out and say, yes, we recognize, you know, that there's, you know, been concerns in the community and also voiced internationally about the way, you know, the police handled the protests on Wednesday, the 12th of June. And, yeah, we'll have an inquiry into that. That's something that kind of any you know, or many, you know, normal countries with functioning governments would do in this kind of situation. And I don't see that as a big ask from the government. So I'm surprised that they haven't, you know, offered up that. And I was also surprised in the, you know, Carrie Lam's, you know, lack of proper apology until very late in the piece. I mean, you know, everything that she did, you know, after the second big protest, she should have done after the first. And why, you know, 1 million people wasn't enough, but 2 million was, sort of, is, you know, the mind kind of boggles what, you know, what was going on in terms of the political calculations there. But yeah, so I feel like the Hong Kong government really haven't done themselves any favors in sort of the way they behave continues to provoke people to come out and to protest. And as I say, I don't think that the protesters are asking for you know, sort of crazy demands, but maybe, you know, if the Hong Kong government, you know, keeps pushing back like this, the demands will get more demanding. Demands get more demanding. I mean, the demands will get, you know, bigger. They'll get bigger asks, and you know, that's going to be even harder for the government to meet. So yeah, I just feel that the way the government has handled the whole affair is sort of a complete disaster from beginning to end, really.
What do you think the Hong Kong government's inability to meet protesters' demands says about Hong Kong's relationship with the PRC in one country, two systems.
Yeah, no, there's clearly a sense that people feel that the Hong Kong government's sort of taking instructions from Beijing, and that there were reports in the media, and I assume they're fairly reliably sourced, saying that, you know, it was actually Beijing who pushed Carrie Lam to back down after
the
protests.
She totally denies that she got any pressure from Beijing to implement
it. To implement it, that's right. Yeah. The official story's always been, and again, I spoke to a couple of the reporters who said they felt that the sourcing was solid, that, this was Hong Kong's initiative. Once Hong Kong floated, that Beijing sort of said, sure, we'll take that, and got behind it. But they weren't sort of imposing that on Hong Kong in any way. And I think which is why it was perhaps easier for them to then say, you know, when things took a turn for the worse, to tell Hong Kong to back down again. But, you know, clearly there's, you know, one of the key sources of anxiety in Hong Kong, and one of the key sort of reasons why this particular law caused concern in the community was that very issue of the relationship between Hong Kong and Beijing. I think an anxiety among people in Hong Kong that Beijing was getting increasingly proactive in its sort of involvement in Hong Kong affairs, and that Beijing wasn't living up to its side of the bargain of, you know, letting Hong Kongers run Hong Kong with a high degree of autonomy. And that's sort of, I think, one of the many things that causes discontent. One of the ways that, you know, the Hong Kong government and Beijing might try to, you know, diffuse the sentiment here and sort of improve the sentiment of the Hong Kong community is to sort of back off a bit and allow a bit more freedom and a bit more participation in the governance of Hong Kong than they've been allowing over the last few years.
But that would be an even bigger backing down in a certain sense, right? Because they've kind of done these things that you mentioned, like disqualifying legislators, like kind of punishing the umbrella movement people.
Yeah,
so to kind
yeah.
of like back down from that would be like, well, we've been wrong for the last 5 years.
Yeah, so, I mean, it's obviously... Yeah, in a way, easier for them to not do things. So to act by inaction rather than to sort of make bold policy initiatives, or to suddenly, you know, as I think would be very welcomed if they decided to, you know, kickstart the political reform process again and talk about universal suffrage for the chief executive. But there are things they can sort of stop doing, like, you know, once the people have voted and put people into office, you know, let those people actually hold the office that people have voted them for, to not actively interfere in elections in the way that they do, to not so obviously and you know, increasingly brazenly issue instructions to Hong Kong legislators and call, you know, senior Hong Kong government people into the liaison office for meetings and those sorts of things. I mean, if, you know, in a way, if they just sort of backed off a bit from the various steps they've been taking, I think that would be a good start to sort of reassuring the community that they are serious about allowing one country, two systems to continue to function in the way that everyone initially envisaged that it would.
I think one interesting thing about the withdrawal thing that you were talking about, like the argument about semantics, is in Carrie Lam's last press conference last Tuesday, where she came out and apologized again and said, oh, well, you know, people, like, media after media were asking her to say the word withdrawal,
right,
basically.
Yeah.
And she just could not, like, every time she was, like, kind of trying to explain how, like, it's dead in the water, you know, but she couldn't. So, like, afterwards, the impression you got was that someone told her she couldn't say the word withdrawal.
Right. I see. Interesting.
So it was really interesting to see, like, the impression that gives people, because I think at the beginning people were like, her apology seems pretty genuine.
The second one, I guess, was. Yeah.
The Tuesday apology
seems, right,
like, genuine, and she seems to be, like, doing better. And then, like, as the Q&A went on, people were just like, she is digging a hole for herself.
Yeah.
That's, like, worse and worse. So it was interesting to see, like, maybe there is something, like, happening that doesn't really give people faith in one country, two systems.
Yeah, yeah. And I think it doesn't help that, you know, Carrie Lam is clearly not a woman of the people, right? I mean, she's, ever since she took office, there's sort of been jokes around about how out of touch she is. And her inability to communicate on, and I think that the disastrous sort of TVB interview she gave, where she sort of was weeping what people regarded to be crocodile tears and sort of referring to the Hong Kong people as wayward children, effectively. You know, these sort of continued mishaps in terms of, you know, just communication and messaging that an experienced politician, you know, wouldn't make. I mean, she's not a politician; she's a lifetime civil servant, sort of thrust into a political role. And so, it's difficult to have faith in the one country, two systems arrangement when the person who's supposed to be sort of safeguarding that and upholding that is someone that the community just doesn't have trust in because they can't communicate and can't sort of win the support and the trust of the community. So, it's a tricky position for her.
Beijing might have done better getting somebody who seemed more outwardly sympathetic to the people.
Yeah, right. And the other candidate that lost against her, John Zhang, was sort of someone who was more personable and, you know, might have been more welcomed by the people. But, I mean, you know, Hong Kong has had, you know, now four chief executives, none of whom have been particularly successful. Donald Zhang was sort of the most popular, but, you know, then ended up being sort of, you know, convicted for misconduct in public office, which conviction was just, you know, quashed by the court, you know, this week. But the others have all been sort of disastrously unpopular. But that's what you get when they're not chosen by the people, right? It's sort of imposed upon them by this sort of small circle election committee. And effectively, it's Beijing's favored candidate that wins that quote-unquote election. So,
yeah, I remember when we were here in 2014 for the Umbrella Movement, it seemed like there could be no more hated chief executive than CY Leung at the time.
Exactly. Yeah.
But now it seems like Carrie Lam has maybe cratered.
Unbelievably seems to have topped that or gone below that nadir that CY Leung had plumbed. Yeah, it's quite amazing.
I think that's it on my end.
Well, I guess maybe the last question is, what do you see as the end game for these protests?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. I've sort of been thinking about that, and I don't have one answer. I have a couple of different possibilities. One is that things just sort of peter out. You know, the community sort of is not happy, but I guess generally, you know, satisfied that this particular issue at least is resolved, and they'll, you know, kind of go on with rumblings of discontent, and the student protests will probably slowly die down, and everyone will sort of get back to whatever fraught normal there was. That's sort of one possibility. The second possibility is that we're in for kind of a long summer of discontent, and these student protests continue. You know, large popular protests, you know, may also recur, and you know that things, you know, the pressure continues to increase on the Hong Kong government such that, you know, maybe there is some kind of movement. I don't think it will be Carrie Lam resigning, but maybe they do sort of take some positive policy actions to try to settle things down again. In a way, there's another possibility, you know, where things sort of get, you know, even more unstable. If the government, and you can see that happening, if the government makes more missteps or if the police make more missteps, although the police clearly are being very careful to be backing off in a lot of their policing since that Wednesday, the 12th of June. But if there's more missteps from the government and the police that creates more discontent, we may see bigger protests, and there's a path that probably isn't such a desirable path for Hong Kong or for most of the Hong Kong community, where things get, you know, even more unstable. But I don't know which of those possibilities to handicap. I think the last is probably least likely. I think it's either going to fizzle out or to sort of continue with this baseline ongoing protest and discontent until at some point, you know, either it dies out or the government does something to sort of, you know, keep people slightly happier. But always difficult to predict the future.
I think that's one thing that, since we've been here this time, people have just constantly told us how surprising they've been, right? What's been happening these past few weeks.
No prediction has been accurate so far.
I mean, people who were saying, you know, we talked to some activists after Carrie Lam came out and said that the bill would be postponed on Saturday, and they're like, oh, well, this probably means that Sunday's protest will be smaller.
It was twice the size. Was remarkable.
So that's pretty interesting. So I understand you're you don't want to.
If I had to predict for Monday, my feeling is that Monday will be big again. It might not be, you know, 2 million or 1 million, but I think it's not going to be insignificant. That's my best guess. Just from talking to people, people are still upset and annoyed, and it's a public holiday and it's a traditional day of protests, and they want to come out again. That's my sense.
But so somewhere between 100,000 and 7 million.
Yeah, right.
Out of 7 million Hong Kongers.
Yeah, that's a good estimate. I'll run with that. Yeah,
led by a charismatic foreigner who hosts the TV show and podcast.
Right, there you go.
Well, thank you so much for joining us. If those listening want to learn more about you and your work, where should they go?
I'm very active on Twitter. My Twitter handle is AntD, A-N-T-D. I have a website which is my name, anthonydapperan.com, where you can sort of see some of my writing. And, of course, you can buy my book, City of Protest, published by Penguin.
Great. Well, once again, thank you for joining us. And thank you for listening to China Unscripted. Once again, I'm Chris Chappell.
I'm Shelley Zhang.
And I'm Matt Gnezda.
Talk to you next time.